You're listening to the Talking Rheumatology Podcast, brought to you by the British Society for Rheumatology.
Hi, I'm Marwan Bukhari. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of Rheumatology, and I'm very pleased to be presenting this roundtable discussion on the recent VSR myositis guidelines. I'm just going to go around the table, the virtual table, of course, and I'll get everybody to introduce themselves, starting with Professor Chinoy.
Hi, Marwan. I'm Hector Chinoy. I'm a Professor of Rheumatology at the University of Manchester and an Honorary Consultant Rheumatologist at Salford Royal Hospital.
I'm Alex Oldroyd. I'm a NIHR Academic Clinical Lecturer, and I'm a Rheumatology Specialist Trainee based at the University of Manchester.
Hello, I'm Lisa McCann. I'm a consultant paediatric rheumatologist at Alderhay Hospital in Liverpool.
Hello there, I'm James Lilliker. I'm a consultant neurologist at Salford Royal Hospital and also honorary senior lecturer at the University of Manchester.
I'm Phoebe Rush and I am a juvenile dermatomyositis patient and I'm also a junior doctor in Liverpool.
Well, thank you very much. We'll start our discussions really. So let's start with James. So can you please give a brief summary of the guideline, why it's needed and what it contains?
Yeah, thanks, Marwan. So this is a culmination of several years' work now. And I think what we all agreed right from the outset is that the care of patients with myositis has been hampered by the lack of good quality evidence to help guide our treatment decisions. So we brought together a group of professionals as well as patients from throughout the UK to really work on this problem, sift through all the evidence that's available to us, try and identify the high quality evidence and pool it together and really agree between us on some important points of best practice around the treatment of myositis. And it really does focus on practical advice and guidance around the treatment of the condition rather than its diagnosis. But we did take quite a broad scope, so it doesn't just cover the treatment of the muscle disease, it also includes the skin disease, also includes joint disease, what to do if there's respiratory involvement, what to do if your patient becomes pregnant or is breastfeeding. So it's quite wide-ranging, but does focus on those practical elements of treatment. And as you say, I think this is really important. It's the first guideline of its kind. It follows a very rigorous process of production to make sure that it's as unbiased as possible. And I think it's going to be a really useful resource for not only professionals, but also patients in the future.
Is there an international element to it as well?
No, this is a UK-produced guideline. We do have representation from the different nations within the UK. But it's not international in that sense. And there will be a focus inevitably on guidance that's tailored towards treatment within the NHS. But we do take into account evidence from the literature as a whole and produced from all countries. But no, it's a UK-focused guideline committee and a UK-focused publication.
Could it be used, though, by international readership?
Yeah, absolutely. I think notwithstanding potentially some of the limitations of it being focused towards UK practice, I think there'll be some really useful advice and guidance around treating patients with myositis across the globe.
So the guideline provides paediatric and adult-specific recommendations. So why was this done? How can this benefit patients?
So this is the first BSR guideline that spans the age range from paediatric across to adult age groups. And I think our group are incredibly proud of that fact. And I know other guidance groups are going along the same lines now. I think it's crucial. Whilst there are many similarities in the paediatric onset disease and adult onset disease, there are also distinct differences. And an example of that is the lack of cancer-associated myositis in juvenile onset disease that really needs to be clear within guidelines. There's other things that are different between children and adult onset disease, including increased risk of calcium deposits in children compared to adults and many other features. So I think it's really important that healthcare professionals are aware of that, and also that patients or parents or their carers that might come across these guidelines and read them are also really clear about these differences. So I think it's absolutely crucial that it did include paediatrics and adolescent and adult within the same guideline.
And I think it's a good idea that we really do have a transitional element to it as well. Was that addressed in the guideline?
Absolutely. We didn't address transition specifically, but we did try to cover topics relevant to transitional services. And I think this is a key thing that comes up time and time again when we talk to young people in our focus groups that have transitioned from paediatric to adult services and all the difficulties that they have kind of come across. And I think we can't underestimate for young people the challenges of getting a chronic disease, potentially during their formative years, and the long-term impact that that can have on their well-being, their psychological health, their employment prospects, their education. And so there are a lot of issues that adult rheumatologists need to be aware of that are very, very relevant to transitional care.
Thank you. Alice, can you briefly describe the process behind the evidence collation and how the recommendations were formed?
Yeah, sure. So we followed the process of that the BSR set out in collating evidence for guideline and recommendation formation. I'm not going to go into loads of detail about that, but I suppose in summary, a systematic review is carried out, and this is carried out by the team at King's College London. And once we had all of the research papers together, these were all reviewed. We then aimed to draw out all of the evidence from there. Once we'd done that, we formed some draft recommendations. And then with an expert group from people across the UK, we amended these recommendations and refined them. The whole process is approved by NICE. If anyone wants any more details, they can have a look at the full manuscript and also any of the supporting documents as well.
So the National Institute for Healthcare and Clinical Excellence in the UK is very approving of the whole process. Because of the time it takes, would you suggest that it might be able to take in extra evidence after the time cutoff, or was it very rigorous of where you got the evidence from?
Yeah, so all of the papers that we included was up until October 2020. We didn't include any evidence after that. We need to make a cutoff point somewhere, and obviously any further evidence that's come out after that, we couldn't use to form the recommendations. Obviously, when we come to review the guideline again in the future, any new evidence that comes through can be assimilated as well. It's also important to say that appropriately, the BSR process states that we have to form recommendations on evidence. We can't just form a consensus recommendation that isn't based on evidence. And this means that there are some areas that we weren't able to form recommendations on. There's some recommendations that we couldn't be completely precise on because there wasn't evidence. But this has actually been a great opportunity to identify the gaps in evidence and form research agendas for the future.
What recommendations relating to medications do you think are most relevant? So what will the general or pediatric rheumatologists be taking from this? What's new to them? Let's start off with Lisa.
So I think most children with juvenile dermatomyositis are treated within specialist centres. And so the medicines will be judged and prescribed by pediatric rheumatologists. But many of our general paediatric colleagues or other healthcare professionals will be involved in shared care of those patients. So I think increasing knowledge for them of the type of medicines that these patients might be on is useful. I think another key message within the guideline, particularly in paediatrics, but I'm sure it's also relevant in adult onset disease, is a key message that early aggressive treatment is needed and leads to a better outlook. So we would be very keen for people to recognize the disease, to contact us if they're concerned about the possibility of dermatomyositis, to contact us if they're concerned that a patient may be flaring, so that we can treat appropriately and get the disease under control to give the best possible outlook for individual patients.
How about adults, Hector? What's new? What will a rheumatologist take from these?
What we've attempted to do, Marwen, is provide some standardised guidance for our colleagues. And to keep it fairly simple and straightforward, we all know that we have to use high doses of steroids in patients with inflammatory myopathy, and we've outlined the dosing ranging between 0.5 and 1 milligram per kilogram per day. So that's usually 40 to 60 milligrams a day. We've advocated the use of intravenous steroids in certain situations if there's reduced absorption of the tablets. Knowing what the lack of evidence base for adult disease, we're still able to provide guidance on the use of disease-modifying drugs, immunosuppressives, and we've outlined which drugs should be used in adult-specific disease as well. We've gone on to make recommendations for the use of rituximab as second, third line therapy, and also situations where IV immunoglobulin will be necessary as well. And abatacept is another treatment consideration for biologics. So really it's a stepwise recommendation process that will provide some standardization for our rheumatology colleagues dealing with myositis.
Have you created an audit tool that will be going with it?
Yes, there is an audit tool, and we've already provided the specific questions that should be associated with the audit so that people can assess their own practice and whether they're adhering to the guidelines. Lisa, I think you wanted to add something there.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that the audit tool also includes, it's a simple checklist, but it also includes areas where it's not applicable to certain patient groups. So there's some aspects of the guideline that's not applicable to pediatrics or to adults, and that's clear within the audit tool as well. So hopefully it will be easy to use.
The guideline addresses a number of biologics. You've mentioned quite a few of them. Do you think this will impact clinical practice? Will people have to go to centres of excellence to get these biologics, or do you think that they'll be adopted because they're nice in dose that people can give, for example, abatacept and rituximab within the regions?
I think one of the most important things about the guidelines, Marwen, is it provides awareness to the general rheumatology audience, other people reading these guidelines, so they'll know for definite which biologics are recommended in myositis, namely rituximab and abatacept. In terms of the availability of the drugs, as you're aware, in England, we have restrictions whereby drugs endorsed by NHS England policies should be given in specialist centres. But there is flexibility there. So as long as an MDT discussion has taken place with the specialist centre, the drugs can often be given locally, making it more convenient for patients who would otherwise have to travel large geographical distances to get to the specialist centres. And there's just the issue of a recharge where the funding goes to the specialist centre and they need to reimburse the local centres.
And that's obviously a very UK-based answer, and everywhere else will have a different way of reimbursement. Thank you.
We have an additional issue in paediatrics. So some of the Commission guidance, for example, for rituximab is for adults only. And within NHS commissioning, we're allowed to use that in children under certain regulations, including them being postpubertal. So we do struggle with children kind of younger than usually the 12 is kind of the cutoff, but we can struggle with access to those medications at a younger age. And it doesn't quite fit with the evidence because the rituximab trial included children.
The guidelines provide recommendations relating to management of myositis-related ILD. Can you please summarise these and how will they impact practice?
So myositis-related ILD, it's one of those disease manifestations that can have a big impact on patients. And, you know, in general, we see the acute, early, severe sort of form, so the rapidly progressive form. And we also see the long-term chronic form as well. And for adults, we've been able to form treatment recommendations on both the rapidly progressive and the chronic form. So I won't go into great detail, but we've provided recommendations on the use of steroids, DMARDs such as cyclosporine and tacrolimus, and also cyclophosphamide and rituximab as well. So this can help anyone helping a patient who's got myositis-related ILD, be they a rheumatologist, neurologist, or respiratory physician, deciding which drugs to use and when for patients as well. Now, it's really important to say that there just was not at all enough evidence to form treatment recommendations for children with myositis-related ILD. And this is obviously a big gap in the evidence base that it's really important to address in the future. We've also provided some practical recommendations about how to screen for and assess for ILD in patients of all age groups as well.
Lisa, exercises are quite important in managing myositis. What should clinicians advise the patients regarding exercise, and how can this give some benefit?
Thank you, Marwen. So I think increasingly we realise the importance of exercise. So exercise is safe, but also a really useful and effective adjunctive treatment along with medications to improve muscle strength, cardiorespiratory fitness, and also actually health-related quality of life. So it is a key thing that we need to include in our management of patients with dermatomyositis of all ages. When we talk to young people that we look after, they tell us that we can't just tell them to do exercise, we need to tell them how to do exercise in a practical way. And I think that's really where our multidisciplinary team come in. So with the help of our physiotherapists and occupational therapists, they can give very structured exercise programs to help children, young people and adults with exercise when they've got their disease. As young people get older, they often say that even then they can benefit from additional kind of ways of helping them with their exercise. So, for example, health coaching programs that may be signposted to them by GP surgeries. And I don't know whether Phoebe has any other things that she would like to add to this, because I think it is so essential that we get young people and adults doing exercise with this disease.
I agree with you with getting involved with the MDT. I was also wondering as well, sort of phrasing it as a, this is part of the treatment plan. It's not a, oh, and at the end, can you do some exercise as well? Sort of then people, I take my medicines and I do my exercise, make it sort of part of the plan, and maybe trying to put together things like videos. I guess in lockdown, a lot of people have done gym programs online. So then that can appeal to a lot of different levels. And if you aren't able to make it to a physio and with sort of resources being a bit scarce with these things, that could be a good way for people to do that at home. And if they do visit specialist centres, they don't have to travel a long way to exercise.
Okay, thank you. Let's talk about skin disease. So we provide a number of recommendations in the guidelines about skin disease. Can you summarise these and what's the take-home message?
Yeah, thanks, Marwan. We do make a few recommendations around skin disease, although I would highlight that it is one area where the evidence base is particularly sparse. But we were still able to make some recommendations around the use of rituximab in refractory skin disease, around the use of IVIG in refractory skin disease, and the importance of sun avoidance and using sun cream, etc. One important element that came out, although we had to make a pediatric specific recommendation, was around looking at reduced nail fold capillary density and using that as a marker of ongoing skin disease activity and integrating that into your treatment decisions. There may be relevance there for adult practice, just the evidence wasn't there in the literature for us to make it a more broad recommendation. And another thing which I'd like to highlight as well, in the mental health section of the guideline, we highlight the importance of, skin disease is often the most visible part of someone's myositis, and it can have a significant impact on patients' mental health and quality of life. And we just emphasise the importance that should be addressed as well. And again, if Phoebe has some comments, I think that'd be really, really helpful.
Yeah, so I think the inclusion of the mental health aspect is really important. Obviously, sort of, as well as the physical parts of it, there's the mental burden of having a chronic disease, and then also the impact of medications and things like steroids on mental health is really important. I think even just educating patients on that this is a thing and it's okay to find that hard is like a good step for them to getting help, and offering things like counselling I think could be really helpful.
Okay, so wait, are there any other elements of mental health, Alex, that you've also considered within the guideline?
Yeah, so just to start, echoing what Phoebe was saying, the quality of life and mental well-being aspects of living with myositis it's a huge priority for any patient groups we talk to. And, traditionally as doctors, we focus on the drugs and the medications and tend not to address the quality of life and the mental well-being aspect. So, one thing we wanted to do was just to raise the profile of this so that it's routinely considered. The other areas that we focused on that was pediatrics specific was pain, muscle weakness, and poor sleep. Now, we don't have any answers of how to address all of these, but it's one of those things that all of those areas should be addressed and look for. And if there's anything that can be done with medication or managing disease activity, then that should obviously be considered as well. There weren't any other particular aspects, and this is obviously an area that doesn't have a great evidence base. So again, as I've mentioned before, this is an area that needs a lot more research with the aim of addressing all of the quality of life and mental well-being aspects that aren't necessarily addressed through medical treatment of the condition.
Going back to the audit tool, actually, do you think that this will lead to better myositis management?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, the idea of the guidelines is to create a minimal standard, really, isn't it? And to raise the standard of care across all age groups. And I think the audit tool is just a tool that allows units to assess their practice against national guidance and to make sure that they are considering all aspects of care, which includes access to counselling or psychological services. It includes access to physiotherapists, occupational therapists. And I know this sounds very straightforward, but one of our UK nurses, Polly Livermore, has done some work looking at access to care in paediatrics to psychologists, and there is still a postcode lottery, and that's not what we want. You know, all patients should be able to access the care that they need. So I think audit tools can be useful to identify gaps in services. I think comparing those gaps against national guidance can help with service development in individual hospitals or individual units. And so I think I would hope that this will improve standards of care across the UK and also make it more uniform. We want to avoid that postcode lottery.
Let's go through and ask about the gaps. James, where do you think there's been any gaps that you've found? Have you found any big gaping holes in the evidence base?
I mean, I think as with any guideline process, you'll come across areas where there's some evidence, but it perhaps doesn't meet your standard for inclusion to form a full recommendation. And that was certainly the case here with myositis, where amongst autoimmune rheumatic diseases, I think the evidence base is particularly sparse for myositis. One of the major issues is simply around some of the specifics around, say, the sequencing of different immunosuppressive medications. You know, there's very little head-to-head data of the different DMARDs, for example, or the exact doses or durations of those treatments. So people may read with some frustration around, you know, not being told an exact dose or duration of certain medications, and people will have to use their professional judgment in that regard. I think the other frustration is around some of the more novel treatments, say JAK inhibitors, where there are some case reports or small case series, but not enough evidence to form a formal recommendation as part of this guideline. And then similarly, some of the factors we know can be particularly problematic in patients with myositis, say the risk of cancer or the risk of cardiovascular involvement, we've managed to make some recommendations about how you might screen for those problems, but the exact method that you want to use locally or how often you should do it in those very specific terms, we've not been able to really drill down into. We're only able to make quite broad recommendations. So I think this guideline in many ways is a very important starting point, and we've been able to identify some gaps in the literature and focus our future research to try and fill them. And I'm sure that in coming years, there'll be an update to this guideline, which fills some of those holes. Hopefully we'll look forward to producing that as a team again amongst the adult and paediatric teams involved here.
Okay. Well, finally, a question to all of you. Any new evidence that you think will be coming through?
James has already alluded to the use of JAK inhibitors, and we're actually in the process of carrying out a JAK inhibitor trial in the UK. There's JAK inhibitor studies going on in other countries as well. It's looking like a very promising treatment for the use of calcinosis as well. And so for the first time, we may actually have a drug that that can help our patients who have these troublesome lesions, both adults and children. There's increasing evidence now, up-to-date evidence, for the use of IVIG. And this didn't make this current guidelines, the cutoff date, but it's definitely adds to the historical evidence base for the use of IVIG in steroid-resistant patients. So, you know, these are just two examples of drugs that will help to reduce the steroid burden in our patients, because myositis, and amongst other rheumatic diseases, we're using the most amount of steroids in these patients. And as you say, in patients who already have underlying weakness. So we're giving a drug for muscle weakness that in the longer term can cause problems with weakness as well. I'd like to think we'd have more personalized based treatment, but I don't know whether that's going to be ready in time for the next guidelines. But antibody stratification is proving to be very useful. what we're increasingly learning now is certain combinations of antibodies can predict certain prognosis as well. So it could be in the future that we have a whole panel of combinations of myositis antibodies that tell us something about the patient and what they're going to respond to in terms of treatment and their prognosis as well. So it's a great time for myositis. We've finally got some guidelines, and there's clinical trials happening in this rare disease. So there may well be one or two licensed drugs available as well for the next version of the guideline.
I agree 100% with Hector, of course. I think coming very much from a paediatric perspective, I would love all trials of myositis to include children. It still doesn't happen. So we will continue to have this dichotomy of evidence available in adults and not available in young people. It's absolutely key that all future trials include children and young people, that our patients and the parents that care for them want that. So I think that's really important. I think the other thing we really struggle with, and I hope we'll get more evidence for this in the future, is which drug is better. There's very few trials that compare one drug to another. In the pediatric cohort, we were able to use the PRINTO study, which compared steroids alone against steroid and methotrexate and steroid and cyclosporine, but that really is the exception. So it would be nice to have more on that. And it would also be really important to be able to define drugs for specific complications. So calcinosis, as Hector's mentioned, but also interstitial lung disease, or these rare complications that can be particularly difficult in children to define which treatment is better.
Thank you for listening to Talking Rheumatology, brought to you by BSR. Please do rate, share and subscribe through your favourite podcast app.